a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Webb, and we are in room 414 of the Capitol Building in Pierce, South Dakota. My name is Gary Hansen. With me are Commissioners Christy Feagin and Chris Nelson. We'll check the phone to see who's joined us telephonically. Susan Stewart.
Yes, I'm here, Your Honor. And Brian Weiss from Mid-American is on as well at another location.
Who else is on?
Brian Weiss.
Okay.
Hopefully you have his name.
Yes, I do. Thank you. Tom Welk.
Tom Welk is not attending, Your Honor. This is Jason Sutton, one of his law partners, and I'm attending on his behalf.
Thank you, Jason. Meredith Moore.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Philip Schenkenberg.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Jason Topp.
Present, Mr. Chair.
Scott Swear.
Present, Mr. Chair.
Juanita Brown.
Present, Mr. Chair.
Well, welcome to all of you. Is there anyone else on the line with us this morning whose name I did not call? We'll get started then with administrative items. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes of the Commission meetings held on September 10th, 2013, and September 24, 2013, and the ad hoc Commission meeting held on September 17th of 2013. Is there a motion on those minutes?
I move to approve all three sets of minutes.
Thank you. Are there any additions, deletions, or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none. Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The minutes are approved. Consumer reports. Status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the Commission. Ms. Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission received a total of 103 contacts since the last report was prepared for the September 24th, 2013 Commission meeting. 9 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 31 of the contacts involved electric service, 5 contacts involved natural gas service, 21 contacts involved cell phone service, 21 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 2 contacts related to One Call, and 14 contacts related to issues not regulated by the Commission. 1,433 of the 1,480 complaints received have been resolved.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Nelson.
Could you maybe just expound on some of the types of questions you might be getting from out west at this point?
Most of the questions right now are just when will power be restored. Ms. Van Gerpen and I spoke with Black Hills Power this morning, and they have just a little over 5,000 customers left to reconnect and understand there's some challenges there with 55 inches of snow when we're to put some of the snow to move to get in power poles. There are some issues where the masts have been pulled away from homes, so it's unsafe. So once power has been reconnected, it is being disconnected again until an electrician can come in and fix that. We understand Black Hills Power is going to help facilitate some of those and help some of those electricians along with supplies if needed so that people aren't out, because they've heard there's some shortages for that equipment in the area.
Okay.
So they're working with that to make sure that happens a little quicker.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any further questions? We recognize that there's a real significant event that took place out in western South Dakota, and a lot of folks are struggling out there, and we appreciate everything that the utilities and people are doing for not only themselves but for other people. And thank you for bringing that up, Commissioner Nelson. Natural gas, the first item, first docket item on our agenda is NG13-005 in the matter of the filing by Mid-American Energy Company for approval of continuation of the incentive gas supply procurement plan. The question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the continuation of Mid-American's incentive gas supply procurement plan without modification? Mid-American, we will begin with you.
Yes. My name is Brian Weiss. I'm Director of Gas Portfolio Planning and Trading at Mid-American Energy Company. Also, you heard on the phone is for Mid-American is Susan Stewart, who's a Managing Senior Attorney for Mid-American Odyssey City. First off, we'd like to thank the Commission for its consideration of our request to extend Mid-American's Incentive Gas Supply Procurement Plan, or IGSPP, for an additional three-year term. There are three key elements to the IGSPP. First, the IGSPP establishes a market-based benchmark for key components of our natural gas supply costs. Second, the IGSPP requires a periodic comparison of MidAmerican's actual cost to the benchmark. And third, the IGSPP establishes a sharing mechanism, and that allows MidAmerican to retain a portion of the difference, whether that's favorable or unfavorable, between our actual costs and the established benchmark. The IGSPP is a benefit to MidAmerican South Dakota customers by providing an objective, quantifiable standard for measuring our performance in procuring natural gas supply and related services. The IGSPP helps align MidAmerican's interests with its customers' interests through participation in both favorable or unfavorable outcomes of ongoing purchasing decisions. Since the IGSPP was first approved by the Commission, and that was in November 1995, MidAmerican's achieved a total of $38.4 million in savings relative to established benchmark costs. MidAmerican South Dakota customers have retained $30.4 million of that, or around 78%, while MidAmerican's retained $8 million, or around 21%. If you look at the past 5 years, which probably are more reflective of current market conditions, MidAmerican's achieved $9 million in savings relative to established benchmarks, of that, MidAmerican South Dakota customers have retained $7.7 million, or 86%, while MidAmerican's retained $1.3 million, or around 14%. Just a note on current market conditions. Current market conditions are much the same as in 2010, when the IGSPP was last approved. We continue to see very tight spreads, both locationally and over time, for instance, between summer and winter. And those tight spreads do limit savings opportunities on one hand, but they've also provided some opportunities to extend transportation contracts, which for traders or marketers who are looking to capture favorable economics, the contracts aren't perceived to be as valuable. Well, MidAmerican acquires those contracts for the reliability of providing delivery to our customers. So we were able to extend some maturity. So there's kind of some limited opportunities, but there's also some opportunities to extend transportation. We do still see some opportunities available in the marketplace, but we're having to work very hard to achieve maybe penny opportunities here and there, where years ago we might have been looking at much larger opportunities to achieve savings for our customers. I'd like to thank you again as a commission for considering our request to extend the IGSPP. We appreciate the work of staff over the last month in evaluating our requests, and hopefully we provided information that was necessary in the data requests that they did offer. With that, Susan and I would be pleased to answer any questions or comments the commission might have.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff has nothing more to add. Just recommend approval without modifications with an effective date of November 1st and available for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions by the commission? Mr. Rizlov.
Mr. Weiss, if you could expand a bit. You talked about transporters and the advantages this offers them, and I found that to be interesting. Could you explain a bit more about what you had said earlier?
Yeah, certainly. What we've seen to some extent and heard talk of probably to a greater extent is every year a number of transportation contracts come up for renewal. We generally extend our transportation contracts on around a 3-year cycle. What we've seen is, because geographic spreads are fairly tight, for a pure trader or a marketer, the reservation costs that they'd have to pay to extend transportation agreements, they're not able to earn as much off of trading from buying gas at the receipt point and delivering it at the delivery point. They're not able to make a financial margin on that greater than the cost of transportation. Or the price that they would be able to offer for transportation is less than what the pipelines are willing to accept to renew the contract. So we've seen some volumes get turned back to the pipelines, and where we have had some contracts come up for renewal in the last year, we've been able to extend those for 3- and 4-year terms, maintaining some of the discounts that we had. So from that standpoint, we're able to take advantage of a market opportunity that's maybe detrimental to a pure trader or a pure marketer.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there a motion?
In NG 13-005, I will move that the Commission approve the continuation of MidAmerica's incentive gas supply procurement plan without modification effective November 1st, 2013.
Thank you. Discussion of the motion. Commissioner Nelson.
Aye.
Commissioner Feagin.
Feagin votes aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Rulemaking docket. RM 13-002 in the matter of the consideration of standards to govern avoided cost determinations. Question before the commission is, today shall the commission open a rulemaking docket? Mr. Rounds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Rounds for staff. Back in May of last year, or maybe before that, in the evidentiary hearing in docket EL 1106, staff suggested opening a rulemaking to determine what constitutes an LEO. If you remember, we had some issues with maybe setting a precedent in the case, in the Oak Tree case, as far as determining whether or not they had an LEO. In the commission's following order, the commission ordered staff to open a rulemaking, not only determining what goes into an LEO, but also a couple of the different variables that go into avoided cost. So this is just a formal request to get that process going. We've asked interested parties to comment on those issues and probably what our next move will be is to take those comments and determine sort of a straw man proposal that we can start moving through and potentially pass some rules.
Thank you. Is there anyone either on the phone or in the audience who would like to provide any input on this item at this time? If not, questions by the commission. Brian, would you include in such a rulemaking process, would you consider looking at higher demand charges for the producer? Production caps, credits versus cash payments, things of that nature. Would you anticipate we would be looking at those items?
The value of capacity credits, you know, and how that relates to different generation sources could be a topic. The avoided costs, in most cases, won't take into account a production tax credit, because that's more of the generator side of the QF side of what their cost is going to be, and really we're talking about how the utility determines the cost that they can avoid.
I'm trying to think of whether you understood my question on that. You answered it 98%. In some venues, they are looking at giving a credit to the home owner, to the producer, rather than rather than giving them a cash payment, rather than reducing their bill, giving them a credit to use.
Are you talking about more like distributed generation, like a net metering type of?
Yes.
I don't think we'd get into those types of policies. I think this rule is going to be applied to generators of 100 kilowatts greater.
Oh, okay.
That might be up to you. There might be suggestions, you know, depending on who, what types of comments we see. There might be suggestions to change the way that we have tariffed rates for those smaller generators. That's not our plan at this time.
So you would be potentially looking at production caps, though?
I don't think so. I think, the way that PURPA has been interpreted in most cases is the avoided cost to determine the amount that the utility can take. So no matter what the utility is going to have to take the power, it's just a question of whether or not they can avoid costs to take the power.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions by the commissioners? Commissioner Nelson.
you mentioned you've gotten some feedback from some utilities already. Is that correct? And are they wanting us to go forward with something like this?
I've got a lot of questions from both QFs and utilities about how quickly the commission can make a decision on avoided cost, and whether or not they set precedents in the Oak Tree case, things like that. I think everybody would probably be better served by having a little bit of certainty as far as what variables are on the table. If you think about utilities trying to determine their avoided cost, there's a lot of different debatable items, and to the extent that the commission can steer some of those in one way or another or box those, I think that would be helpful to both parties.
Well, and I will say certainly when we were going through Oak Tree, I was feeling that and certainly would have agreed with that. And then since then, we've had V&H, which just seemed to work without our intervention or rules. Is there a potential that if we promulgated rules that you could make those types of agreements harder to come to between the two private parties as opposed to our involvement?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Right now we have basically an open field that the two companies can come to an agreement. The issue just becomes, if they can't come to an agreement, who's going to move which variables which way? And, to the extent that we set some of those variables, you could definitely cut off some of those projects.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pagan?
I think I have the same questions that Commissioner Nelson has. I know I signed the order that suggested that we open up a rulemaking authority, but I'm not for sure if that's absolutely the best way to go because we also need some flexibility. And I would sure like to hear from some of the stakeholders that would be involved before we open up a rulemaking authority and spend a lot of time by stakeholders and staff and et cetera. So I'm going to suggest we defer this action today until they send us comments that we can read before we vote on this and open up rulemaking authority, because sometimes when we make rules, it's unintended consequences, and I want to make sure that we don't go down that path.
Thank you, Commissioners. Brian, this is, in some circles, has been described as this process, rulemaking process, as potentially being a very arduous task. Would you care to comment on that?
If the Oak Tree case is any indicator, I think it will be. It depends on who shows up. If there are a lot of differing opinions, then it will probably be an arduous task. And if you look out across, the rest of the nation, every state has a different way that they interpret what avoided cost is. I think it's going to definitely take a lot of time. I think the logic behind writing these rules is to avoid another Oak Tree case. So you have another Oak Tree type case that takes 2 years, and then another Oak Tree shows up and that takes 2 years. Is it better to just have one rulemaking process?
Thank you. Just partially answered my question, but the question I'm going to ask. Regardless of the challenge and how arduous it might be, would you still perceive this as being necessary to do? Do you still think it's something we should embark on?
I mean, I think it's a proactive way to avoid another Oak Tree. Oh, yes.
Thank you. Any further questions? Mr. Smith.
I don't know that this is a question. I might have a comment, and Commissioner Feagin and Brian may want to weigh in on it. But today I don't think, you know, we're not really initiating the, quote, formal rulemaking necessarily at this point. This does not in any way obligate. You know, I think with your comment, Commissioner Feagin, on input, I think one of the reasons for opening it would be to get input. And there's no commitment at all to promulgate rules by opening this. It doesn't in any way presume that you're going to actually issue rules. But I think by opening a proceeding, it provides a formal, it just provides a spot, you know, and a formal spot for people to weigh in, tell us what they think, and see if we're gonna, if it's worth it, we think, after what we hear, to go forward. And I'm not arguing for a rulemaking here, because I know how much work this is gonna be, and I don't necessarily like the thought of it. But we may want to at least open this up just to kind of hear what people think. I wouldn't mind knowing what they think, but again, I'm not arguing with you, Commissioner Feagin, I'm just expressing a view. Ryan, did you have a thought?
If I can differentiate, I think what Commissioner Feagin's asking is to ask the parties whether or not we should make this rulemaking, whereas the letter says once we open this, we want comments on what the rules should be. So if we want to have a first step that just says, do you think this is necessary, staff wouldn't be opposed to that.
Okay, fine. I just thought we'd have a little discussion about that. And a lot of times we do these with two dockets. You know, we do one, which is the comment, you know, the initial sort of what do we do, if anything, phase, and then we open up a formal rulemaking. And I guess I wasn't sure which one this was intended to be at this point.
I mean, what we could do is if, opening the rulemaking doesn't require us to write rules, but what we could do is send out another letter and say, you know, hold off on those comments. First, let's comment on whether or not you think these rules would benefit the state.
And, John, I certainly appreciate your information for us. The only thing I'm a little concerned about is opening up a docket and then all of a sudden going down an avenue of a lot of staff time and stakeholders' time yet, and then we don't do anything. So I want to make sure that this is the right move, although I know you wrote the order and we signed it. But I just want to make sure that this is good for all stakeholders.
Commissioner Nelson?
Since it looks like we're kind of in the discussion mode, just trying to figure out where we're at, I don't know whether we need to open this or not, but I definitely would like to get input from the affected parties. I was a little surprised maybe that we didn't have some today that would say, yeah, that we need to move forward, or no, we shouldn't. And so whatever the best mechanism is for us to get some feedback from the affected parties, I would like to hear that. And maybe it is to open up the rulemaking and simply with the understanding that it's, at this point, solely to get feedback on whether or not we open up a second docket to actually move forward, asking that question. And then if we were to move forward, what areas would you like us to address? I guess those are the pieces of information I'd like to get, and whatever the best method of getting there is, that's what I'd like to pursue.
I think statement just now expresses exactly how I feel about it. Appreciate those comments. Any other discussion at this juncture, Mr. Rizloff?
If I could ask this, with the potential or the pending movement from the interconnected system, integrated system, whatever they call themselves, Wappan Basin and Northwestern being the primary players, in the moment we're joining an RTO, how do you see that affecting the necessity for rules?
My understanding is that just drops the eligible QFs from 80 megawatts to 20 megawatts. So we would still have the 19.5 megawatt oak tree types.
Any further discussion? We are ready for a motion.
Well, I guess I'd maybe go back to Brian. Given what you've heard me say, would you like us to open up this as a formal docket, or should we throw those questions out there and have them respond to those before we move forward?
I guess I see a docket as a holding place for an issue. So, you know, to the extent you want to take comments and put them somewhere, I would suggest opening the docket and just have that as be the opening request.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got a motion if it's appropriate. I move that we do open rulemaking docket RM13-002 with the sole purpose at this point of receiving feedback from the affected parties as to whether or not they would like to see us move forward with rulemaking, and if so, what areas they would like to see us address.
Thank you. Discussion on the motion?
I have a question for Mr. Smith.
Commissioner?
He talked about kind of an A and a B, or step one and step two. Are we doing it the way that this would be step one and not necessarily step two?
Yeah, I think this is just step one at this point.
This is kind of an informal yet.
Yep,
it'll be a placeholder on our website so people can see the comments.
As I understand it, yeah, it's just to create a formal way for us to, one is to get people to respond, I think, to provide a structure where we can receive input, I think, is really this
part. And what will step two look like? What will that motion or what will that procedure look like for step two?
Well, normally what happens is, first of all, step one, I think where it leads is, first of all, to a decision of, are we going to proceed with issuing rules or not? And secondly, if so, at least in a general fashion, what are those? And then the way we usually do it, and Rolaine, you can weigh in too, because she actually handles the rulemakings, and she may want to weigh in. But normally at that point, once we've got that package put together, and there may not be any, then we open up what's called a formal rulemaking, where then we get down to, okay, what's the precise language and what are we doing here phase.
If I could just weigh in, I mean, I don't foresee this real, and Brian, correct me if your understanding is different, but I don't foresee this taking much staff time at all other than your making sure that all the parties know that we want their input at this point.
Correct.
Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan?
Fegan votes aye.
Hanson votes aye. The motion carries. Next docket is telecommunications TC 11-087, in the matter of the application of Native American Telecom, LLC, for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services and local exchange services in South Dakota. The questions before the commission are, today, shall the commission grant NAT's motion to take deposition of Sprint's expert Randy G. Farrar? And secondly, shall the commission grant NAT's motion for grant of temporary authority, or in the alternative, expedited decision? We will take these as one question at a time, not in their entirety, to the extent that we can discuss them without going over the others. But the first question before us is, shall the commission grant NAT's motion to take deposition of Sprint's expert, Randy Farrar? So we'll start with NAT and then certainly entertain Sprint's concerns. NAT, Mr.
Thank Swear. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Mr. Swear. Mr. Chair, before we start, we may be getting into some confidential business information regarding these two motions. And I'm wondering if it would be appropriate at this time if the commission would consider taking these two matters up in a confidential session.
We will take them up in confidential to the extent that we discuss confidential items. However, we will not place the entire discussion as a confidential. So if any of the parties believe they are going to address confidential items, they will have to inform us before they make any confidential statements. Then we will go off the web and we will make certain that only parties in the room are a part of the only persons in the room are parties to the docket.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, regarding the motion to take the deposition of Mr. Farrar, under FDCL 15-6-26B4, this is what the motion is made under. As the commission is aware, Sprint's in-house expert witness, Randy Farrar, has filed sworn written testimony under oath in this case on two different occasions. His first written testimony was filed on March 26th of 2012. His second written testimony was filed on August 13th of 2013. And Mr. Farrar's written testimony in both of those submissions opines on a number of topics regarding NAT's application for certificate of authority. Number one is, of course, that Mr. Farrar has claimed that NAT is some type of sham entity. Mr. Farrar has also opined on NAT's financial stability. He's indicated that he believes that NAT has been established for traffic pumping purposes. He's also opined that it's not in the public interest to grant NAT's certificate of authority. He's also opined that NAT is not providing any benefit to the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe, and he's also opined regarding NAT's future profitability. We think in this case that a deposition of Sprint's in-house expert is not only should be granted, but is necessary to be granted in this case. I think, as Mr. Schultz said in the last time we brought this up, in his 30 years of practice, he's never had to go through this process before. The attorneys simply agree to take the depositions of their respective experts. But we have gone through the process now. So we are asking the commission, again, we have a very broad scope of topics that Mr. Farrar has provided written testimony on. NAT is also, pursuant to the statute, willing to pay Mr. Farrar a reasonable and appropriate fee. However, the commission should take into consideration who we're deposing here is an in-house expert who's an employee of Sprint. He's an employee of Sprint. It's not in the typical expert witness situation where you have an outside expert. This is actually an employee of Sprint. So what we've asked is, Mr. Schenkenberg has proposed that we pay Mr. Farrar $100 an hour for his time at both the deposition and in preparation. And what I've asked Mr. Schenkenberg is how Sprint has come up with $100 an hour for Mr. Farrar's testimony. I've just found out in the last day or two that apparently Sprint has an internal analysis of what it believes Mr. Farrar's fee should be. I've asked for that information, and it hasn't been provided to me. I don't think either it's NAT or the commission can determine what a reasonable fee is for Mr. Farrar without some type of numbers from Sprint. And again, we've requested it. We're simply asking that we be allowed to pay the same fee for Mr. Farrar that Sprint's paying him as an employee. And neither the commission nor NAT can determine what's reasonable or appropriate without Sprint providing us with its analysis of the fee request. The other issue with regard to this deposition is the length of the deposition. The parties have been trying to negotiate the length of Mr. Farrar's deposition. Sprint originally said they'll make Farrar available only for 3 hours. And we, of course, said that that's not acceptable. Under 15630B2, South Dakota law provides that a deposition is limited to 1 day of 7 hours. And additional time can be allowed for a fair examination if the deponent or his attorney impedes or delays the deposition. So what we're asking for in length of deposition is what the rules provide. We want 1 day, 7 hours of deposition time, subject to coming back before the commission if Sprint attempts to impede or delay during those 7 hours. And finally, the scope of the deposition. Once again, under 15.6.26, that's the standard for deposition discovery. If it's relevant to the subject matter and reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. As Sprint has pointed out throughout these proceedings, it's a very broad standard. We have approximately 70 to 80 pages of pre-filed testimony provided by Mr. Farrar. Now, we're confident that we can get this done in 7 hours as long as things go smoothly. So, again, what we're asking is the commission allow us to take the deposition and the deposition be taken in a way that's consistent with the rules of procedure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swear. Mr. Schenkenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. We appreciate the opportunity to address you on this issue. We believe that CCT or NAT, and I think that we used CCT, Crow Creek Telecom, in our pleadings because Mr. Swear had switched to that acronym. I know I see that he's now using NAT. I hope if I use those two interchangeably, it won't be too confusing. We do believe that NAT's request to depose Mr. Swear is not in accordance with the rules. We were here a month ago before you on our motion to quash, and you decided that the rules mean what they say and should be followed, and that NAT hadn't followed the rules because they hadn't filed a motion for a deposition of an expert witness. And here we are again a month later, and when you look at the rules say that the default is no expert depositions unless there's a special reason to do it. And when there's a special reason to do it that is extraordinary, it is done with appropriate scope limitations and appropriate fee shifting. Commissioner Nelson asked a month ago, I think was curious as to whether and why Sprint really opposed this kind of deposition. And there are two reasons. Practically, this is going to create uncompensated costs, even if Mr. Farrar's even if the cost of Mr. Farrar's time is compensated for. There's in-house lawyers spending time on this. My travel costs, my fees will not be paid for by NAT. There's court reporter costs. And it costs the organization to take an employee away from his or her normal duties to be deposed. Beyond that, as you know, Sprint and NAT are in disputes bigger than what we have before you in this docket. And the issue of NAT, through its counsel, spending time digging into areas that have nothing to do with this case is very much concerning to Sprint. You've already decided that this case is about NAT's qualifications, not about Sprint's qualifications, and allowing a deposition without appropriate scope or a deposition at all is going to incent Mr. Swear and NAT to use this deposition for purposes other than getting to the truth about what this case is about. As I said, the default under South Dakota law, and regardless of what practice might be at times between parties in the past or what someone's experience is, the rules that are in place and have been in place provide that there is no need in the normal case to do depositions of experts. As long as you understand what the opinion is, as long as you've been told what the facts are that the expert relies on, you just go to trial and you cross-examine your witness there. And that's what the law is in South Dakota. It's what it is in Minnesota. We provided a case to you out of Massachusetts in which a judge said you really got to find special circumstances in order to change the default result. And if a court simply decided that a party's willingness to pay the fee of the expert was enough, you'd be disregarding the rule. There really isn't anything in this case that sets this case apart. Mr. Farrar's testimony has been provided. The facts on which he relies have been provided. NAT has every opportunity to prepare for trial using that information and can and should do so. This is just a garden variety situation in which an expert has provided an opinion and the other side wants to create cost by doing a deposition, and the drafters of the rules have said that isn't necessary. With respect to scope, if you do decide there is a need to do the deposition, there are two important scope restrictions that we're going to ask you to issue an order on. And I would remind the commission that the rules do say with appropriate limitations on scope. And the first is the topic matter. As Mr. Swear indicates, there's testimony that's been filed. The 2012 testimony is not relevant. Mr. Farrar has said he's not offering that at trial. He's replaced it with the August 2013 testimony. That ought to be the focus of the question. If this deposition is necessary for NAT to prepare for hearing and to understand Mr. Farrar's testimony, then that ought to be the scope of the deposition. And the fact that Mr. Swear does not want to agree to any scope on the deposition tells me that he wants to use this as a way to get into many other topics that aren't relevant, and that's not appropriate. It's also inconsistent with the rule, which, again, the rule focused not on the broad discovery standard, but it's focused on the need to depose an expert about the basis for his opinion. With respect to time, it is true that the default under the rules is 7 hours, a full day. We think a half day is appropriate. The commissioners may not have any personal experience in this area, but 3 hours is a long time to ask questions. And certainly if we're obstructing the process, you ought to take us to task for that. We will not do that. I did depositions in our case with Northern Valley of four conference call company representatives. None of those went a full, none of those went a half day. A half day is plenty of time to depose somebody. A skilled lawyer can get the work done in a half day, and we think that's consistent and appropriate in these circumstances. Finally, on compensation, we have had back and forth on compensation. I understood Mr. Swear's position to be that he would pay no compensation. I now understand his position to be something different. I do have an analysis. I was not able to hit send on that before the hearing, but I do have it here. I guess what I would suggest, and it is an analysis that looks at the cost to the company of Mr. Farrar's time based on what his compensation is and benefits, et cetera. This is not an outside expert witness fee, which would certainly be twice to three times plus $100 an hour. So what I would suggest is this, that the commission not make a decision on the dollar, the $100 per hour request, but direct the parties to continue to negotiate on that. I'll provide the analysis to Mr. Swear, and perhaps you can ask Ms. Wiest, if necessary, to mediate any disputes that the parties have, just so we don't have to come back to you with this problem. But I suspect we'll be able to get there. That's all I have, members of the commission. In summary, we don't think it's appropriate to do a deposition. If you decide otherwise, we do ask for appropriate limitations on scope. And have addressed the compensation issue Mr. Swear raised. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Weiss, did you have any comments on this? Any questions by the commissioners? I have one. Mr. Schenkenberg, obviously you will have Farrar available at hearing, correct?
That's correct. If he does not come to the hearing, his testimony would not be admitted, and it wouldn't be in the record. He will certainly be at the hearing, yeah.
And Mr. Swear, the word extraordinary was used, and I haven't looked at the law on that recently, at least. Do you know of non-confidential reasons that you can tell us? What special reason you would have that you have to go through a deposition process rather than having the witness available at hearing?
Yes. Mr. Commissioner, that's a misnomer of the law. Nowhere in FCCL 15626B does it say anything about that it has to be extraordinary or special circumstances to take an expert deposition. And perhaps the commission could ask Mr. Schenkenberg where he got that language. but it's clearly not in the statute. So it's not an extraordinary or special circumstances standard here. It says the court may order further discovery, and then we can also talk about fees and expenses as the court may deem appropriate. It says nothing in there about extraordinary or special circumstances. And in a case like this, Mr. Schenkenberg said that everybody's going to a bunch of expense. NAT surely doesn't want to have to go to the expense of this entire proceeding. It's going on for 3 years now. Sprint decided to intervene. They put themselves out there. All we want is like every other case that's done in South Dakota. We want to be able to take a pre-hearing deposition of what will be a very important witness. And we shouldn't be forced to just have Farrar appear and wing it on cross-examination. So, again, if extraordinary or special circumstances, not required under the rule.
Thank you. I wish to mention I recognize that there are a number of interveners in this docket besides Sprint, and I guess I am intentionally ignoring you. I'm looking at it from the standpoint of the second question, assuming that you're on the line to participate in that. However, are there any other interveners, anyone else associated with this docket, who feel compelled to speak to this issue? Sort of a marriage deal, if speak now or forever hold your peace.
This is Jason Topp. We do not take a position on this issue.
Thank you. If there is anyone, please speak up. Otherwise, I'll look for other questions from commissioners. Commissioner Nelson?
Just one for Mr. Schenkenberg. You've talked about this analysis of Mr. Farrar's time value. What's the dollar figure?
The dollar figure for the average in his pay grade is just below our $100 number that we proposed, and he's an above average in his pay grade. I think I said that correctly.
Understand. Thank you.
Commissioner Feagan?
Just a comment on analyzing the cost of an employee, just to remember that it's more than the wages. It is also opportunity cost and the people that support them and their office and all of that. So a lot of times when you look at an employee, it's more than their wages that cost a company to have that employee. So when you negotiate, make sure you look at all those type of things.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, I'd entertain a motion, and what I would like to do, rather than incorporating the limitations, the three limitations that have been discussed, first decide whether or not we actually want to grant the motion to take a deposition. If we do not, then there wouldn't be any need to address the limitations. If we do, then we can take the limitations one at a time. Is that fair?
With that understanding, because I definitely want to address those limitation questions, I would move that we grant Nat's motion for leave to take deposition of Sprint's expert, Randy G. Farrar.
Discussion on that motion? Hearing none. Commissioner Feagan?
Feagan votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. The motion carries. Next item is the limitation on a request from Sprint of $100 an hour. I would mention that I'm involved in a court case where a deposition was just taken. I think it was a week and a half ago, and I paid $175 an hour to an expert witness. So maybe I got bamboozled a little bit, but I recognize that person was a different expert and on a different topic. However, I've paid $100 on a number of occasions for expert witnesses, at least in my experience. Right. Other discussion? Ms. Wiest.
I was just going to say, for that one, I would recommend that the commission take Mr. Schenkenberg's request and have the parties try to come to some sort of agreement on their own.
And you will take it under the further suggestion of Mr. Schenkenberg that you would be the arbiter in that?
Sure.
All right. Commissioner Nelson?
Typically, I would take Rolaine's advice, but in this case, I would like to settle this today because I do not want this little issue hanging out there and one more excuse for a delay in this deposition.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
And with that, I would make a motion that Mr. Farrar's time be compensated at $100 per hour for the time spent in the deposition only.
Discussion on the motion.
Hearing none. The prep time is not included?
I would not include prep time because that, again, is another nebulous number, and I don't want anybody fighting over nebulous numbers. I think we're past that. And these are all issues that he's adequately prepared for as he put together his testimony, and so it should be things that he's very familiar with. And again, I don't want to leave any more nebulous numbers out there for the two parties to fight over.
I value Commissioner Nelson's opinion of trying to move this forward, but I'm going to vote no on this motion because I think the parties should be able to agree. Rolaine should be able to mediate, and they should be able to do it by the end of the week. So it's Wednesday today. By Friday, they should be able to do that.
Thank you, Commissioner Feagin. My only comment would be that as soon as I heard that they've had an opportunity to discuss this, they've had an opportunity to reach a conclusion on it and have not. And the very first thing I thought of when it was suggested that they get back together again and talk about it is that this docket, the NAT dockets, have taken an extraordinary period of time, and we just need to expedite it, make certain that it gets taken care of. If I thought $100 was outlandish, then I would say, okay, let's discuss this, or I would come up with a different number. But I really think that $100 an hour is reasonable for the expert witness. And from my experience, even as testifying as an expert witness, I think that $100 is reasonable, so I'm going to support the motion. Any further discussion? If not, Commissioner Feagin.
Feagin votes no.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. That brings us to the second proposed limitation, which is to restrict the scope to Farrar's August 30th testimony. And my immediate thought on that is that if you're going to have an expert witness before you, should be allowed to pursue whatever that expert witness knows and the nooks and crannies and ask whatever questions need to ask. Further discussion on that item? Hearing none, is there a motion?
I move that there be no restrictions placed on the scope of the deposition.
Discussion on that motion? Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. The third item, third proposed limitation, is to limit it to 3.5 hours. We're looking at a discussion between either a limit of 3.5 or 7 hours. So,
I move that there be no additional limitation beyond the 7-hour limitation provided in statute.
Discussion on that motion?
The statute provides for 7 hours. I don't know that we sitting here today can adequately determine how long this is actually going to take. And I think if that's a limitation that statute has, that we ought to give that full opportunity.
Further discussion? Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. The next question before the commission on this docket: shall the commission grant NAT's motion for grant of temporary authority, or in the alternative, expedited decision? NAT?
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This is Mr. Swear again. Mr. Commissioner and fellow commissioners, we brought this motion based upon the fact that when this docket was started back in 2011, we never envisioned that we'd still be here in October of 2013. And when I argue in favor of this motion, I'd like the commission to keep this in mind. What is the harm in granting this motion? NAT is providing services that have never been provided before to tribal members on the reservation. NAT has been providing local telecommunications services on the reservation since 2009. They've been operating under the Tribal Utilities Authority approval to provide local telecommunications services within the reservation's boundaries. The benefits that NAT is providing is, number one, affordable local telephone service. That's important because Verizon is no longer an ETC providing affordable lifeline service on the reservation. Therefore, NAT service is an essential service for tribal members. Verizon's no longer an ETC out there providing affordable lifeline service. NAT is also providing affordable broadband. Again, non-tribal broadband offerings, not affordable, and they're used by very few, if any, of those tribal members. NAT's broadband services are essential, again, for those tribal members. And again, the question is, what is the harm in granting this temporary authority? NAT has, the filings in this case are a mess. It's clear that NAT has the financial and technical capabilities to provide telecommunications service. NAT right now, because it's entered into agreements with other IXCs, is now operating in the black. Now, the specific financials have been provided, and I'm not going to comment on those now because the commission is aware. Sprint's decision to not pay is based on their national agenda to litigate other than to comply with federal law regarding access stipulation. Sprint's made a big deal out of NAT's financial capabilities. As of June of 2013, Sprint owes NAT almost $1.4 million. They just refused to pay. If Sprint were making the payments it's supposed to make, then NAT would not only be debt-free, but it would have approximately $1 million in the bank. So it's an incredibly circular argument for Sprint to say NAT doesn't have financial wherewithal when they're withholding over $1 million in payments. That's simply a circular straw man argument. Also, NAT's application in this docket is limited to providing intrastate interexchange telephone services. NAT is already providing services within the reservation to tribal members. NAT is also providing interstate services pursuant to a lawful tariff that's been in effect with the FCC for years. NAT's application in this docket only asks the commission to provide intrastate interexchange service for traffic that either originates or terminates off of the reservation within the state of South Dakota. That's what it's asking for. And right now, because we have given the utmost deference to the commission, we are not providing those intrastate services that terminate off the reservation within South Dakota. So who is being harmed here? It's the tribal members who cannot make these intrastate calls within the state of South Dakota. There's been no harm that's been shown since 2009. We think that in this case, we're asking for the temporary authority because we believe that until this case finally comes to a hearing, no one is being heard here but the tribal members. We are not charging Sprint or AT&T or CenturyLink for any of those in-state services. All of the information provided by the interveners in opposition to this was old information. It also included interstate numbers. So what we're dealing with here is a company that's been operating since 2009, that's filling a void for tribal members, that's validly operating under an interstate tariff, that's legally operating on the reservation, within the reservation boundaries. All we're asking is that at least until this comes to hearing, for a temporary period of time, we let those subscribers on the reservation go ahead and be able to make calls off of the reservation within South Dakota. Again, I don't know what the harm would be in providing those services, because it's clear that those services have not been provided by anyone else. And with that, I'll ask any commission has any questions. But again, as a very practical matter, what is the harm providing the state citizens of South Dakota with this little sliver of telecommunications service that we're asking for? Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any interveners who would like to comment on this item?
This is Phil Schenkenberg. May I proceed for Sprint?
Please, go ahead. We have some people in the audience here as well who will be chatting with us. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Sprint requests that you deny the motion for temporary authority. The right place to start on a question like this is to find out what the standard is and then to apply the standard, and that's where you run into a roadblock. There isn't a standard for the commission to apply to grant this kind of relief, because this kind of relief is not allowed under the rules or the statute. And the commission, being a creature of statute, needs to follow the rules. There is a process to obtain a certificate. Provision of service before that process has been completed is not allowed, and in fact is designated as misdemeanor. And there isn't a way to bend the rules to allow the request that NAT is asking for. If there were a standard, and some states have a standard like this, have a provisional authority, if there were a standard, it would certainly require, it would be like a summary judgment standard or a preliminary injunction standard, where NAT would have to demonstrate that it was abundantly clear that they were going to win, or it was undisputed that they were going to prove all facts necessary for the relief requested. And you've already denied their summary judgment motion once in this case, and you decided that there were issues raised that had to be taken up at hearing and that you should follow the process set forth in the rules. There are disputed facts. We have submitted testimony that questions NAT's fitness, managerial fitness and qualifications, and its financial viability. The statement made by Mr. Swear about Sprint withholding and suggesting that if Sprint didn't withhold, that this would be a company that was viable and in the black is dealt with by Mr. Farrar in his testimony. He concludes that's not the case. He can be, and part of the reason for that is that the lion's share of that money, if it were paid, would go straight through to free conferencing. Wouldn't go to NAT. And in fact, NAT can't be financially viable going forward given its current business plan. There are also disputes of fact about whether NAT's statements about its intrastate activities during 2013 are true. We submitted an affidavit suggesting that's not true. And I think AT&T did as well. NAT doesn't have a certificate to do business in the state now that it's CCT, Crow Creek Telecom, and we pointed that out in our brief. That's a requirement of the rules. So you certainly cannot find that there are undisputed facts that show that NAT is going to win this case. In addition, there is, I believe there's great confusion and inconsistency about what NAT is asking for. This started as a request for a local certificate, and then it morphed into something much different earlier this year. NAT in its application said that it wanted the authority to provide intrastate access service, which is a service provided to inter-exchange carriers. That's not the same thing that Mr. Swear was talking about a few minutes ago. He was talking about, I think, something akin to originating intrastate long-distance services provided to the Crow Creek tribal members. And it's just not the same thing as what NAT asked for in its application. And I think we quoted a Discover response in our brief in which NAT made it very clear it was not seeking any authority to provide service to any tribal members. It believed it already had that. So we need to unscramble, and the commission needs to have NAT's help in unscrambling what it is it is asking for before you can grant a certificate. Because if you don't know what you're granting, there's going to be further lack of clarity as to what NAT is doing and whether what they're doing is appropriate.
Thank you. Any further direction? We have Mr. Van Camp here in chambers. Good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Your Honor, as the case may be. briefly, Bill Van Camp on behalf of AT&T Corp. And we did file an opposition in this matter, and I don't want to belabor the points made by Sprint, but at this late stage in the game, as staff has been working with the parties to expedite the process to get us to hearing after summary judgment is rejected, now NAT comes and asks for a temporary authority that isn't allowed by statute or by rule, and AT&T filed its opposition and just think that's plainly not allowed by statute or by rule, and for that reason alone it should be denied, and this should move forward to hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Camp. Further presentation on this item?
This is Jason Topp from CenturyLink.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. CenturyLink as well has filed an opposition to this motion. We've got significant concerns associated with the standards. We haven't addressed them as comprehensively as Sprint has, but we have raised some specific issues and raised opposition to this application as a whole. We think that we're entitled to be heard regarding those concerns, and find it very surprising that we would have had a hearing date delayed due to discovery concerns, and then shortly thereafter get a request to have the case resolved, at least in the intervening time period, for while this goes forward. We also don't think it's supported by statute.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to address on this item?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Meredith Moore on behalf of Midstate.
Please go ahead, Ms. Moore.
Thank you. I will provide just a few brief comments on behalf of both Midstate and also SDTA, and then obviously Mr. Coit can fill in if I miss anything. Both SDTA and Midstate acknowledge that the commission possesses the discretion to determine whether the requirements for issuance of a certificate of authority have been met by the party petitioning for that certificate of authority. And neither SDTA nor Midstate is going to weigh in on that particular issue at this time and would simply defer to the commission as to whether NAT has met those requirements. What Midstate and SDTA would like to point out at this juncture is the stipulation that was executed by and between NAT, SDTA, and Midstate in March of 2012. At that time, following representations made by NAT to both Midstate and SDTA, as well as discovery responses filed by NAT, the parties addressed the intended scope of NAT's application for a certificate of authority. And in that stipulation, NAT confirmed its intention to provide service only within Midstate's Fort Thompson Exchange. Based upon that stipulation, both Midstate and SDTA stated their respective intentions not to object to NAT's request for a waiver of Administrative Rule 20:10:32:15, which is the rule that requires the petitioning party to provide services throughout the entirety of that study area. Since the parties filed that stipulation in March of 2012, SDTA and Midstate have confirmed with NAT that it intends to honor that stipulation and it intends to keep the scope of any certificate of authority which it ultimately seeks here consistent with what was agreed upon in that particular stipulation. And so therefore, if NAT did not intend to honor that stipulation, obviously Midstate and SDTA would have concerns with regard to any grant of temporary authority at this time or any grant of an actual COA without a hearing. So in that respect, both Midstate and SDTA would simply ask the commission to keep in mind the parameters of the stipulation that the parties previously executed in making a determination as to what to do on NAT's issue today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. And Mr. Coit is in chambers with us. Do you have anything to address the commission on?
Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff, Richard Coit on behalf of SDTA. I would just indicate that Ms. Moore stated our position well. We continue to believe that the stipulation that we entered into, which is, was filed with the commission, is valid from our perspective. With regard to any sort of grant of temporary authority or final COA, we believe the terms of that are applicable at this point in time. And I just wanted to make that point on the record today as you consider the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Coit. Is there anyone else on the phone or with us today who wishes to testify on this item, this question? If not, I have one question, Mr. Swear. Mr. Swear, do you know of any statutory authority that would allow the commission to grant temporary authority?
Your Honor, or Mr. Chair, what I would say is this, is that this commission, just like any court, would have the authority to grant temporary authority in a situation like this. The commission has volumes of information that's been filed that, at least for a temporary matter, shows that the technical, financial, and managerial experience of NAT meets the requirements. It's been operating, except in this proceeding, extremely well since 2009. So when you ask if you have the authority, I think it's very clear. You have the inherent authority as the decision-making body, just like a court, to go ahead and issue a temporary certificate to give these folks on the reservation these type of services. And you can place any conditions that you think are reasonable on the certificate. But, yes, you have the inherent authority in this case to do exactly what NAT is requesting.
Further questions from the commission on this item, on this question? Commissioner Nelson?
Mr. Schwer, Mr. Schenkenberg has put in some affidavits indicating that Sprint believes that you, or I should say NAT, is continuing intrastate services. And you have told us that they ceased those services last spring. Can you help me resolve that difference?
You bet. The affidavit filed by Ms. Clauser is the cookie-cutter affidavit that Sprint files in all of these cases. That affidavit is not based on what has happened since NAT stopped providing those intrastate services. So technically, the contents of the affidavit are correct. But it's the cookie-cutter affidavit that they file, and it doesn't take into consideration what NAT has done from the time it stopped its intrastate activities up until now. So that affidavit does not take into consideration what's happened since NAT took that step in deference to the commission.
I'm not sure that answered my question. Mr. Schenkenberg, can you try to help me with this?
I can, Commissioner Nelson. I do not know what Mr. Swear means when he says cookie cutter. That's an affidavit that, as I understand it, is a one of its kind. This issue has never come up before in my dealings with Sprint, that a company has claimed to have ceased providing intrastate services and company data has shown otherwise. The information we provided, which was redacted, just to prevent customer proprietary network information from being disclosed publicly, was taken from the Sprint network. Ms. Clouser pulled it herself. It shows calls in August from 605 numbers located within South Dakota to free conferencing 605 numbers. So I do not know what NAT is doing as of October 9th, 2013, but certainly in August, they were not doing what they told this commission they were doing starting back in May.
Mr. Commissioner, this is Mr. Swear. May I respond to that?
Please, because I've not gotten an answer to my question yet.
The NAT, as it's indicated in his affidavits, is not providing intrastate service that starts on the reservation and ends somewhere in South Dakota. What Sprint is referring to, and they know this, what they're referring to are the calls that are terminated on the reservation from Free Conferencing Corporation customers. Those are interstate minutes. Those fall under NAT's FCC interstate tariff. So, for instance, if you're calling from, if you have a free conference calling number and it's a 605 area code number, well, that call can come from, let's say, California, and it terminates in Crow Creek. That is an interstate telecommunications activity. There is no activity that NAT is doing that involves any intrastate telecom services within the state of South Dakota. So what they've done is they've grouped all the interstate minutes together and said, here, you see they're terminating at Crow Creek. Those are interstate, under which, of course, the FCC has jurisdiction.
I believe his testimony was that those calls originated in 605 area codes, though.
The 605 area code is given by free conferencing to their customers. So the 605 area code can be used, let's say, with a caller in California who calls into the 605 prefix at Crow Creek. Again, that's interstate. If we had a person from Sioux Falls, let's say, who was calling on the free conferencing prefix line, and that activity was limited to the state of South Dakota. For instance, Sioux Falls wants to do a conference call, and it terminates at Crow Creek. That is intrastate activity of which NAT is not participating. So, again, our affidavit is very clear. We, in deference to the commission, until the certificate of authority is ruled upon, we are not providing intrastate services outside the reservation boundaries within South Dakota.
No further questions.
Questions? Is there a motion?
I had a question.
Please, Ms. Wiest.
Mr. Swear, when you stated in your motion that you're asking for a temporary authority to originate and terminate intrastate telecommunication services, what type of intrastate telecommunication services are you actually referring to?
Here's what we'd be looking at. We'd be looking, for instance, if someone, a tribal member on the reservation, wanted to call their grandmother in Sioux Falls. That is an intrastate call. We would ask that that temporary authority be granted so that tribal member on the reservation could call their grandmother who lives in Sioux Falls.
But I thought with respect to what Sprint stated in their response to your motion that you stated in a discovery request that you're not requesting inter-exchange long-distance service authority.
Rolaine, could you ask that question again, please?
I thought you was in your amended application, you state that you're asking for inter-exchange access service. And according to Sprint, in a discovery request to staff, you have stated that you're requesting inter-exchange access service and not inter-exchange long-distance service. So what are you requesting?
Well, I think that we're requesting temporary authority to originate and terminate intrastate telecommunications traffic.
But you're not asking for inter-exchange authority.
Intra-exchange authority. I believe we are asking for that also. We're asking to simply be able to provide telecommunication services outside of the reservation, but within South Dakota, to make it hopefully as clear and as easy as possible.
Okay, so what did you mean that you when you said you are not asking for inter-exchange long-distance service in your response to a staff data request?
And, you know, I don't have the data request in front of me. Can you point me to the data request that you're referring to?
I'm only speaking from Sprint's brief. I don't have data requests from staff.
Okay. Well, I think that we'd have to look at that data request because I'm not sure that that's actually what the data request answer was.
And then when you say you want it within the Crow Creek Reservation, Midstate has stated that, you know, and there's a stipulation that you're only asking for authority on the Fort Thompson Exchange. Is that correct?
Yeah, the stipulation that we have with Midstate and with SDTA, that is the stipulation that we've entered into, and it's our intention to continue to honor that as we have.
So when you say within the Crow Creek Reservation, you're really just talking about the Fort Thompson Exchange?
We're talking about providing that at the Fort Thompson Exchange, yes.
Okay, that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any further questions by the commissioners? If not, in TC 11-087, I will move that the commission deny NAT's motion for grant of temporary authority and deny the request for an expedited decision. Is there any discussion on that motion? Commissioner Nelson?
I intend to support your motion, Mr. Chairman, for two reasons. One, I am not convinced that we have the authority to grant what has been requested here. And the other point that I would make, Mr. Schwer had made the comment that NAT is offering services that have never been provided for on the reservation, and in this particular case, we are simply talking about intrastate services, and there are other companies that offer intrastate services. And so the members of the tribe and the folks in Fort Thompson have access to those services already from other providers. So I intend to support your motion.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the motion? If not, Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. The motion carries. Thank you all for your participation. We had a hearing scheduled for later this month, but that's now in a process of being rescheduled, and we sincerely hope that that will be able to be rescheduled without unnecessary ado.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In talking about the hearing, is it looking like we're going to be having the hearing in December, or where are the parties going? Because I don't know if staff has heard back. And Patrick, you may be part of that. Can you, Patrick, give the commission kind of information on where we're at and if you're hearing back from the parties and if they're working with you or what's going on?
Yep, we're shooting for December 11th and 12th for this docket. We sent an email to all the parties, and I believe it's just an 18th that we're waiting on. 11th and 12th of December.
And so, NAT, have you gotten back to the staff, NAT, or are you getting back to them this week, or where are we at there?
Yeah, actually, we emailed Mr. Stephenson this morning just to confirm those dates, and we don't object to that December 11th and 12th date as of right now.
Great, thank you. We appreciate that.
Excellent questions. Thank you for bringing that up. Docket TC13-107 in the matter of the application of Teleport Communications America, TCAL LLC, for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange services in South Dakota. Questions before the commission. Today shall the commission grant the request for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange services within the state of South Dakota, and shall the commission grant the request for waiver of ARSD 2010-32-03-12. TCAL, or Teleport Communications America, Juanita Brown, you're on.
I am on.
Oh. I have a tendency, excuse me, Juanita, I have a tendency to look down at my agenda and working through all my notes, and a distinguished gentleman known to us as Mr. Bill Van Camp is sitting here ready to speak. Is he a person of interest to you?
He is, and thank you, Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Bill Van Camp. It's good to see you're focused on your job. We should all have that singularity. And Juanita Brown is here to answer any questions the commission would have. I just thought before Juanita made her comments that we should point out, and this is from our end, in the filing of that we've made for TCAL to receive a certificate of authority, we also reference a transfer of assets from TC Systems. These are both companies that are wholly owned subsidiaries of AT&T Corp. That was an error. Once we have a certificate of authority, I don't think, and this was in my conversations with Ms. Kramer of SAF, we don't need to come back and ask for a transfer because we won't be, in fact, transferring. We will have a new entity that will have its certificate of authority. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Brown.
Now, Ms. Brown, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this filing, we are requesting a certificate of authority for TCAL, who will be eventually replacing our TC Systems entity in the state of South Dakota. We are hopeful to make this transition by the end of October, assuming we do receive approval for our certificate. And so we would ask that you approve our application as well as the waiver that we filed for the financial portion of the application. And then in addition, I would just like to extend thanks to Robin and Karen for their assistance in getting this before you. And if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you. Ms. Myrink.
Thank you. This is Robin Myrink of staff. Staff recommends granting the certificate of authority for local exchange services with restrictions for retail purposes from offering prepaid calling cards or accepting customer deposits or advance payments without prior approval of the commission, and that the applicant be subject to rural safeguards. Staff also recommends granting the waiver of ARSD 2010-320312.
Thank you. Questions by the commission? I would have a curious one. Juanita, do you know of any prepaid obligations that South Dakota customers might lose at this juncture?
No, I do not.
Thank you. Other questions? Commissioner Nelson.
If I might ask, are you okay with the provisions the staff has outlined?
We are.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, on TC 13-107, move that the Commission grant the request of a certificate of authority for TCAL to provide local exchange services within the state of South Dakota with staff's restrictions, and move that the Commission grant the requested waiver.
Thank you. Discussion on that motion? Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson.
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Brings us to the end of our agenda. Announcements. The PUC offices will be closed Monday, October 14, in observance of American Indian Day. A public input hearing for docket EL 13-028 will be held Thursday, October 17, at 12 noon in the Centennial Rooms of the Student Center on the campus of Northern State University. Another public input hearing for the same docket will be held Thursday, October 17th at 7 p.m. in the community room of the Milbank Visitor Center. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be Tuesday, October 22nd, 9:30 in room 414 of the State Capitol Building. A hearing will be held in docket NG12-008 on October 29th through 31st, beginning at 9 a.m. on October 29th in room 414 of the State Capitol Building, and in room 413 on October 30th and 31st. Commission meetings are also scheduled for November 5 and 22nd of this year. Anything further to come before the commission on announcements? Seeing none, is there a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Thank you. No discussion. Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
Commissioner Nelson.
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. We are adjourned.